Our reading this week brings us to Matthew chapter 25, which means we are really close to the end of Matthew's gospel and getting really close to the crucifixion. I guess that's going to be, we're headed right into that next when we finish.
Yeah, the talking and the teaching's over after this chapter. Then we just come to the climax, and the only talking Jesus does is through his trials and crucifixion.
And how appropriate closing with the two parables and then the judgment.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about that. Do you want to flow 23, 24, 25 a little bit together?
Yeah.
We're in this last week still.
Yeah.
Still kind of dark.
It is.
And difficult times as we get toward the end of the last week.
Right, right. So yeah, so 23, you know, Jesus obviously kind of gives his final graphic ultimatum.
Right.
But it takes no pleasure in it. And so it leads to lament, leads to the disciples as often, you know, maybe a little bit confused or whatever, asking questions. And Jesus ultimately says, you know, catastrophe is coming because this is, you know, the rejection of me is at hand.
For Jerusalem.
Well, for Jerusalem, first.
That's how we divided Matthew 24, the first part, Jerusalem.
Right.
And then the ultimate coming and judgment, which they will be subject to because of their rejection of Jesus.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, and then the old, you know, so Jerusalem and the temple will be destroyed. You know, the end of that because they did not know, you know, they did not recognize Jesus for who he is. But then Jesus makes clear that at least the way you and I share a reading of it, David, in the latter part of chapter 24, maybe about verse 36 or so and following. But of that day and hour, no one knows, you know, the end of the age, I can't tell you when that's going to be, but, you know, the destruction of Jerusalem, you know, comes naturally out of that. It's another down payment of the fact that at some point, God's not just going to end a people, a city, a place. He's going to end the human race. He's going to end history for its rejection of him and Jesus. And so that leads us into these parables, which is, okay, for those who buy into it and want to believe in Jesus and follow Jesus, what do you do while you are waiting for this all to come, you know, for the end to come, which is, you know, how we all live, you know, unless Jesus comes in our lifetime. And that's the thing, it could come at any moment. We forget that sometimes. We think about going to heaven when we die. But the reality is Jesus is coming back, and it could happen at any moment. And so when you understand that, it ought to change how you live. You don't have 70 years to get your life right. You need to be living as though I could be held accountable any moment. And so Jesus tells a series of stories about what his disciples should be doing while they wait for a return that can happen at any moment.
Yeah, which is really, that is the point of verses 1 through 13 at the beginning of 25 with the parable of the virgins.
Yep.
Probably among the more familiar parables to us.
Yeah. You just, at the end of the day, you need to be prepared because if he comes when you're not ready, you're going to miss out. And so don't, you know— practical law application for us today is don't be living as though you have time to clean your life up later. You know, especially young people, I think, fall into that trap, David, right? You know, as long as I don't die in a car wreck or something, you know, there'll be years to come when I can maybe straighten out, you know, sleeping around, the drinking, the drugs, whatever. But there will be a time when I can straighten things out. And the problem is that doesn't just assume that, you know, you're not going to die young. That assumes Jesus doesn't get back sooner than you're ready.
Yeah.
And the door closes. And then what?
I had a friend who spent his 20s using drugs.
Yeah.
And basically just existed at a very minimal level so that he could use drugs every day. And he knew better. And I remember asking him about that one time, said, you know, how could you live with the fact that if the Lord came, you would be lost? And you knew that.
Right.
And he said, never planned to die that way.
As though we have a choice.
As though he knew. 13 is interesting at the end of the parable because there is this admonition to be on the alert.
Yeah.
And I really do think we struggle with that idea because I just don't think we think about the second coming.
Yeah, and there's a theme in Jesus' teaching tucked away here and there in small phrases and words, and so we easily miss it. And it doesn't come up terribly often. But Jesus often warns about, you know, he does sometimes warn his disciples in a little tucked away places that the danger for otherwise devoted disciples is as time goes on, we get spiritually sleepy and therefore less vigilant, and we begin to tolerate seemingly small things perhaps in our lives, you know, maybe not big stuff, but we are not as righteous, we are not as God-oriented, we are not as devout as we think we are or should be because our lamps are going out.
Yeah.
The part of the risk that Jesus knew for otherwise devout disciples is the waiting game and the not knowing exactly when. And for, you know, obviously, you know, 2,000 years so far, it's been nothing but waiting. The waiting itself can tend to wear people out in ways that become spiritually dangerous.
Yeah. Complacency.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and that actually flows well into the next parable in 14 about talents. Surely among the most familiar parables to Bible students,
but not always understood in its context. I mean, this is one you'll, you and I preach. We know this. You know, it's easy to pull these stories out and just use them. But in the context here, part of what Jesus is saying is part of what's getting ready for my return is not just merely don't sin. God expects fruitful production with the gift of life and time that he's given us. And I think we forget that in the context of getting ready for the end, for Jesus to come back, God expects me to do more with my time than just not sin. I need to be, you know, the bringing forth the fruits of righteousness, the fruit of the Spirit, Paul would call it in Galatians. But at the end of the day, God expects me to produce good works in light with what he has declared to be good. And so if I am not basically taking what the Lord has given me, the talents God has given me, the time, the opportunity, you know, and whatnot, and producing kingdom fruit, you know, whether that's evangelism, whether that's, you know, helping out and strengthening the weak and struggling brother or sister in Christ. But the bottom line is, if I'm not producing positively good fruit, I'm not getting ready for Jesus' return.
It makes me think of 2 Peter 3. That's where I was just taking a peek.
Yeah.
About, you know, after announcing the day of the Lord, Peter's question is, what sort of people ought you to be?
Yeah.
There are expectations. We're not just in a holding pattern until Jesus comes. He has in mind for us things to do and acknowledges they're different things, different levels of ability.
Right.
But we're accountable for what we have to do what we can.
Right. And at the end of the day, even if you're not sinning, living in the world, you need to be producing according to the kingdom's values and the kingdom's priorities, right? You know, seek the kingdom first, Jesus says back earlier in this gospel in the Sermon on the Mount. Seek the kingdom first. And that's why we're here and that's why we're alive and that's what God expects us to do.
Can we just say something at this point, since it's in the reading this week, about the reality of hell? Because that is so despised in our culture. If you look at the numbers when people are surveyed, you know, just fewer and fewer and fewer people believe in hell. Though it's interesting, and then if you get into a biblical idea of hell, I mean that number just gets really, really small. And yet, the vast majority of people not only believe in heaven but believe they're going there.
Sure.
And yet it is so crystal clear. I thought about it because at the end of the parable talents. Verse 30, throw out the worthless slave into outer darkness in that place where there will be weeping of gnashing of teeth. And then as we get into the judgment scene that begins at verse 31 and runs to the end of the chapter, very clearly there is a warning that some are going to be told to depart into a terrible place, the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels.
Right.
And so it's hard to read this and escape the reality of hell.
Right.
And especially if you want to embrace the reality of heaven, because heaven is here too. And it's just, you know, you're kind of stuck. It's a package deal. If you're going to believe in heaven, then logical consistency requires that you believe in hell too.
And part of what's sobering about this, David, is again, you know, you got to remember who he's talking to. And he's not talking about those who rejected him going to hell like he was in chapter 23. He's talking to disciples and warning them that you can wind up there too, not because you rejected me, but because you're not a wicked servant, you're a worthless servant. And that's sobering.
Well, that whole section beginning in verse 31 is sobering, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, because ultimately, again, it's not just about a shallow, self-justifying righteousness.
Yeah, the thing I think that is disturbing to people is that in 31 through 46, Jesus takes away the third path.
It's either or. Now it actually is either or.
It's black and white, right? Yeah. And I don't think we like that. Yeah. I remember studying with this guy one time, and he said, you know, I really do want to go to heaven. He was a big football fan. I should have prefaced with that.
Right.
And he said, you know, I know that I'm not living a life nearly good enough to sit on the 50-yard line right down front, he said. I'm just hoping to get one of the cheap seats way up high in the stadium. I just want to get in. That's all that matters to me. And I thought, boy, that just defines a lot of people's life. Yeah. My goal is to be good enough.
Yeah, get as much heaven as I can for as little a price as possible.
That is exactly right. And what the Lord does, and I think I may have even taken him to this text, is he just strips it away.
Yeah.
It's one way or the other.
Yeah.
Either you're in or you're out.
Yeah.
And my fear is there are a lot of people who imagine, I can identify a lot of people worse than me, and it makes them feel okay right. about where they are.
Well, and again, for me, you know, whenever I come to this chapter, the sobering thing again is always, it's not enough not to be bad. It's not enough not to be worldly. Mm. I simply, you know, Jesus expects return for the investment he's made in us.
Yeah. And the flip side of that is, not to make this entirely negative, but the flip side of it is that there is that promise of heaven.
Yeah.
For the people who are devoted to him and committed to his will, for those who are his people,
right?
There's this glorious promise about what is to come that we can hang on to and delight in.
Well, the very first parable, it's a wedding feast. It's a big party that you get in on if you're willing to do what you need to do right now.
Yeah. Well, I think that a reading in Matthew 25 gives us an opportunity to soberly consider reality and what is our future, and to ponder where we stand with God. So big questions as we work on Matthew 25 this week.